who wants to dedicate this shiur today in memory of her father's yahrzeit. Avram ben Zussman should have, the neshama should have an aliyah. We should be blessed with long life and to celebrate many happy occasions. Thank you, and should have good things. Okay, Dr. Sokolov, bakasha.
Okay. So, good evening to everyone. For those of you who might be joining us this evening for the first time, we established last week in our maiden voyage, so to speak. Is that politically incorrect to use that term now? Anyway, we established that there is some question about the origin of the Haftarah, and that the two most prominent answers actually lead us in the two parallel directions that we took last week in our examination of the Haftarah, and that we will continue to take into the foreseeable future, at least. One is the argument that the Haftarah was introduced at a time of persecution, at a time that Jews were forbidden to read from the Torah publicly, but for some reason they were permitted to do public readings from other books of the Bible, and therefore the Haftarah substituted for that week's Torah reading. And therefore, as a substitute for the weekly Torah reading, we have to expect to find a connection between the what would have been the Torah reading for the week and that chapter or that selection from Nevi'im, from the prophets, that substituted for it. The alternative is that it wasn't necessarily the result of persecution. It was simply a way of ensuring that people would continue to value prophetic literature, that they would continue to study prophetic literature. And that led us, as I said, in a parallel direction, and that is to see the Haftarah as something that has a longer lasting and maybe even broader appeal than just to a specific subject within the weekly Torah reading. So we looked at both of those themes last week as we looked at the Sidra of Noach, and we will begin in a moment, as I will share my screen with you, to look at it again in terms of this coming week's Sidra, that is the Sidra of Lech Lecha. Okay, so the sources are posted online at Torah in Motion. Right now, they mistakenly carry the title of Noach, but
not anymore. It's already fixed.
Already done. Okay. All right. So, starting with the theme that the Haftarah is to link up with something in this week's Sidra. And it's clear that the most prominent character in this week's Sidra is our patriarch Abraham, Avraham Avinu. I thought to start off with a little bit of a quiz. And that is to start off with the question of who, in your estimation, was the Tanakh's favorite ancestor? Now, we have, Kanai Nahara, seven ancestors. We have three fathers and four mothers. Right? Arba imahot shelosha avot. Okay, right? We have four mothers and three fathers. Okay? I should say parenthetically, we also have four fathers. Okay? Anybody want to guess who are our four fathers? See, this may only work in the United States. Anybody online from Canada probably won't get this. See, our forefathers are the ones who brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Okay, so as you see, there are seven boxes there on the right-hand side, and I have very neatly covered up each one of them. And in the left-hand side, the left-hand column, or how many times that patriarch or matriarch is mentioned in Tanakh. So you can see, first of all, that there's a considerable disparity. You can see that one of the patriarchs, or matriarchs for that matter, is mentioned 349 times, okay? while another is mentioned only 30 times. Okay, so there is one you know, set, one patriarch, one matriarch who's mentioned more than 10 times as often as pretty much any of the others, right? At least twice as much as one other, three times as much as a third, and almost 10 times as much as the remaining three. Okay? Now, it really, I think it's kind of the leading one is probably a giveaway, right? The leading one is a giveaway. It's a giveaway because even though I'm talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? We are, of course, known throughout the Bible as the children of Israel, right? We're the Bnei Yisrael. Therefore, if you said that Yisrael was the most frequently mentioned ancestor of ours in the Bible, of course, you'd be 1,000% correct. But I was working on the name Yaakov rather than the name Yisrael. And nevertheless, Yaakov Avinu, our patriarch Jacob, was hands down the Tanakh's most favorite ancestor, appearing in Tanakh, as you can see, 349 times. Okay, who comes in second place? You might be able to figure it out by the answer. Because if I have two numbers there, 175 and 236, it would not be unreasonable to assume that we're talking about a patriarch or matriarch who, like Jacob, had two names. And that patriarch or matriarch is mentioned 175 times by one name, and an additional approximately 40 some odd times by another name. Okay? And that, of course, would be this week's patriarch. Okay? Since he is known most of the time throughout Tanakh as Avraham, but as we first met him last week in the tail end of the Sidra of Noach, and as we reunite with him in the opening verse of this week's Torah reading, he is still Avram. And he is called Avram approximately 40 times, okay? So that if we combine the number of times that he's mentioned as Avram and the number of times that he's mentioned as Avraham, we come to a total of 236, okay? Which is not quite 349, but still more than twice as much as the next nearest one of the patriarchs, who was Isaac, okay? Who was mentioned a total of 108 times. Well, there you have it, folks. You don't have to look much further than this to see that there is a gender bias in Tanakh. Okay, if you totaled up the number of references that there are to our three patriarchs, and then you totaled up the number of references that there are to our four matriarchs, right, you will clearly see that the patriarchs are mentioned many, many, many times more than the matriarchs. But we're still not done. We do have four matriarchs. And you might be surprised at some of the answers here in terms of which matriarch is mentioned the most times and which is mentioned the least. Okay? So again, no real way to work this out other than to actually see the numbers. So here they are for you. The matriarch who is mentioned most frequently in Tanakh is Mother Rachel, Rachel Imenu. Second to her is Sarah Imenu. Leah is the third. And for some reason, just as Isaac is the least referenced of the patriarchs, his wife Rebecca is the least referenced of the matriarchs. So I suppose that if there were no other reason for them to be shadchandof to one another, we've now discovered it. Okay. So I just thought that that was a neat way to start. Okay. Now, if we're pursuing the theme that the Haftarah links to the Sidra, then what does this week's Sidra tell us about our ancestor Abraham? So I made just a quick little list of the little vignettes that occur in this week's Sidra, that Abraham left his homeland at God's behest. He sojourned in Egypt and he prospered. He separated from his nephew Lot. He rescued Lot from Mesopotamian marauders. God forged a covenant with him. He was very concerned about his legacy. He fathered a son with his concubine. And finally, at the very end of the Sidra, he performed the covenant of circumcision, right? Brito shel Avraham Avinu. So if these are the things that the Sidra tells us about Abraham, and I were in charge of finding a passage in one of the books of the Nevi'im that corresponded to one or another of these themes, here is an assortment of psukim in Tanakh that I would have chosen to be included as the Haftarah. First of all, we have a passage that you might recognize because it's part of the Seder of Leil Pesach. Joshua, speaking to the people in the very last chapter of the book that bears his name, his valedictory, so to speak, gives them a kind of a thumbnail sketch of Jewish history. And he starts back with reminding them, Be'ever ha'nahar yashavu avotechem me'olam, that in days of yore, your ancestors lived on the other side of the river, which of course is what Mesopotamia literally means between the two rivers. Be'ever ha'nahar would be actually Trans-Euphrates. Okay? The Nahar, whenever we have the Nahar with no additional name, invariably it's a reference to the Euphrates River. So in days of yore, your ancestors lived on the far side of the Euphrates River. Your ancestors were Terach, right, the father of Abraham and Nahor, and that they were originally idolaters. Okay. Va'ikach et avichem et Avraham me'ever ha'nahar. Then God took Abraham from the far side of the Euphrates River. And I led him throughout the land of Canaan. And I multiplied his descendants. And then he gave birth to Isaac. And then it continues, and then it goes down to the fact, as you may remember again from the Seder, and that's already beyond where we've reached in the Torah reading. So why not? The book of Joshua is one of the books of prophets. Why not choose the last chapter of Joshua to be the Haftarah for this week's Sidra? A second choice, an alternative choice, from the book of Yeshayahu. Okay. Lachain, therefore, Ko amar Hashem al Beit Yaakov, thus saith the Lord to the house of Jacob, Asher pada et Avraham. God introduces himself to the Jewish people as he who ransomed or redeemed Abraham. From what did God ransom or redeem Abraham? So if we think of pidyon as being pidyon shvuyim, that's the classic instance of redemption when you redeem a captive from his captors. So wait a second. Abraham was the one who redeemed Lot from captivity. Where was Abraham himself a captive so that God could say that he had redeemed him? Well, if we go back to the previous reference in the book of Joshua, we could say, somewhat figuratively, that as long as Abraham was dwelling amongst idolaters, he was at least in a form of spiritual captivity. And when God took him out of Mesopotamia and brought him to the land of Canaan, soon to become the land of Israel, then God was at least in a spiritual sense redeeming Abraham from a life of idolatry. So perhaps that is the reference, okay? Lo ata yevosh Yaakov. Therefore, if we simply remember, we think back to what God did for our ancestors, then we will find ourselves have nothing for which we should be ashamed, neither shall our faces wax pale. That is to say that we will be emboldened, or we will be made confident by our trust and faith in God the Redeemer. That too might work. Or here's even a third one. Habitu al Avraham avichem ve'osara techol elechem. The prophet Isaiah calls upon the Jewish people and says to them, look at your father Abraham and Sarah who bore you. Hey, that's perfect for our sidra, right? Ki echad krativ, because when I summoned him, when I told him to leave his home and to go to the land of Canaan, he was at that moment in time but one, right? Va'avarchehu, va'arbehu, and then subsequently, as we will read on Shabbat, right, I conferred my blessings upon him and he multiplied. That too could work as a haftarah. And I'm not limited to the book of Isaiah. If I want to choose something from what we call the Nevi'im Acharonim, from the latter prophets, I've got a text from the book of Ezekiel as well, right? God invariably addresses Ezekiel as Ben Adam, right? Son of man. Yoshevei hecharavot ha'ele. The people who are still living in the land of Israel after it was conquered by the Babylonians, okay? Omrim le'mor. Right? When they're waxing nostalgic about their past, they say, Echad haya Avraham. Does it sound familiar? It sounds as though Ezekiel read Isaiah. Right? We just read in the previous verse, Ki Echad Krativ, and here the prophet Ezekiel is remembering the fact that Abraham started off as one, as a solitary figure. Vayiresh et ha'aretz, and yet he was able to come into possession of the land. Vanachnu rabim, and yet we, right, those are the remnants of the people of Israel in the land of Israel after its conquest. Rabim, lanu nitna ha'aretz lemo rasha, right, to us the land is given as an inheritance. So it goes from the future up to at least what in the time of Ezekiel was the present. Or if we wish, we can extrapolate further. We know how to connect the dots, so to speak, into the future, right? And we can see Abraham's coming into possession of the land of Canaan as the model or as the signal for the eventual reunification of the Jewish people with its own land. And yet, none of these is the Haftarah that was chosen for this week's Sidra. Even though, actually, the third verse, the one that invokes Avraham and Sarah, is part of a haftarah. If it sounds somewhat familiar to you, it's because it's one of those haftarot that we read over the summer, one of the so-called Shiv'a Dinachemta, one of the seven haftarot of consolation that are read from the Shabbat following Tish'a B'Av, up to the Shabbat preceding Rosh Hashanah. And that's why, as we now move into what actually is the Haftarah of this Shabbat, do you recognize the reference to Isaiah chapter 40? Well, you might. I just gave you a clue. The first of the seven Haftarot of consolation, the one that is read on the Shabbat immediately following Tisha B'Av, is called Shabbat Nachamu, right? The Shabbat of Consolation, because its Haftarah comes from the beginning of the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah. The very first verse in that chapter, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami, Yomar Eloheichem, right? Nachamu, be consoled, my people, thus says the Lord, right? That is the Haftarah that immediately follows after Tisha B'Av, okay? And it takes up the first 26 psukim in that chapter. In fact, the first five words that you see on this page, Va'amitz koach ish lo ne'edar, are the last five words of that Haftarah. So it's taken us seven haftarot of Nechama. Then there was Rosh Hashanah. Then there was Shabbat Shuvah. And then there was the first days of Sukkot and the last days of Sukkot. And then there's the Shabbat of Breshit and the Shabbat of Noach. So it's taken us 13 weeks. But 13 weeks, we're back in the 40th chapter of Isaiah, beginning now with the 27th verse. And since, as we know from our introduction last week, that Haftarot generally consist of no fewer than 21 psukim, just to remind you, just as in the Torah reading of the week, we call seven people, and each one reads a minimum of three psukim, so that there is no sidra in the Torah of fewer than 21 psukim. So it was ordained that the Haftarah too should consist of at least 21 psukim. Okay, so since we read the first 27 psukim of Isaiah chapter 40 in the Haftarah of Shabbat Nachamu, we begin this week's Haftarah with verse 27, and we will continue beyond chapter 40 into the beginning of chapter 41. But having mentioned the Sidra of Nachamu, and since it's going to take us an awfully long time before it comes around again, if we're still doing this Wednesday night session come next summer, I hope that I will remember to retell this anecdote to you then. If not, or even if I do, there's a good chance that you'll forget it by next August, July or August. So I'll tell the anecdote to you now. Perhaps the most famous reading of the Haftarah of Nachamu, the Haftarah that follows the Shabbat, that follows Tisha B'Av, and that consists of the invocation, be consoled, my people, says your Lord, occurred in Jerusalem, in the Chorva synagogue, in the summer of either 1920 or 1921. I didn't really prepare this, so I'm not sure of the exact date, but I can tell you the exact circumstances. Okay. Circumstance one is that it marked the first week in Palestine of the British High Commissioner, Sir Herbert Samuel. Right? You know that immediately after World War I, Palestine was given by the League of Nations as a mandate to Great Britain. And Great Britain administered Palestine as a mandate until 1947, when they gave up the mandate. Okay? And during that interim of some 27, 25 plus years, right? The British government was represented in Palestine by the High Commissioner. Okay, if you've toured around the city of Jerusalem, especially if you've gone to the neighborhood of Arnona or even Talpiot for that matter, if you've gone along the Haas Promenade, I'm sure that the building has been pointed out to you at one time or another. It's called the Armon HaNatziv, literally the palace of the High Commissioner, okay? And he arrived in Palestine during the summer, and on his very first Shabbat, he walked to the Chorva synagogue, where they honored him by calling him for the Maftir, by calling him to read the Haftarah. And the Haftarah, believe it or not, was Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami. And it made a tremendous impression on the Jewish community of Jerusalem and the Jewish community throughout the land of Israel, throughout Palestine, because here was a Jewish high commissioner of the land of the Jews in a synagogue in Jerusalem, reading the prophecy of consolation of the prophet Isaiah. Okay, that's the story of Shabbat Nachamu and the Haftarah. Okay, so here we go. And this is the Haftarah of this Shabbat. Lamma tomar Yaakov utedaber Yisrael, right? Nistura darki me Hashem ume Elohai mishpati Yaavor. Remember that this is a prophecy of consolation, okay? consolations are generally not offered to people who are leading free, prosperous, productive lives, okay? Consolations are generally offered to people who are living lives of either slavery or enslavement of one sort or another, who feel that they are frustrated by their lack of success, okay? Who are estranged either from home or from family, right? Those are the situations that evoke consolation. And therefore, we understand that what stands behind this verse are people, the Jewish people, in the Babylonian exile primarily, but perhaps even those who remained in the land of Israel after its conquest, who are saying, Nistara darki, that it is though God is hiding himself, right? That my derech, my path, my work, my travail is hidden from God, and my judgment, right, my mishpat, that which is due to me by law, seems to have la ya'avor, seems to have passed me by. Okay, so what we have to be looking for here are words of encouragement that the prophet Isaiah is offering to these people who are worn down by their life in exile, who yearn to be reunited with their families and with their homes, okay? Who see themselves working and slaving, maybe not slaving in the sociological sense, but perhaps slaving in the physical sense, working hard and not seeing any productivity, not enjoying the fruits of their labors. So what does he say to them in the next verse? Halo yadata, what you should know is, right? Im lo shama'ata, even if it isn't something that you're currently, presently hearing, even if it doesn't, even if at the moment it's cognitively dissonant. Nevertheless, he says, you should know this. You should know this on the basis of your recollection of past history. Elohei olam Hashem. God isn't just some local potentate that on one day he's successful and the next day he isn't. So on one day his people prosper and the next day they're sent into exile. No. Borei kitzot ha'aretz. This is God the creator. Lo yi'af, lo yigaf. He can toil ceaselessly without tiring. In cheker litvunato, there are no limits to his knowledge. You think that God doesn't know what's happening with you, right? There are no limits to God's knowledge. And not only is God himself a being who never tires, he is noten la ya'eif koach. God grants strength to those human beings, frail human beings who are tired. Ula enonim, and to those who think that they are at the end of their rope, otzma yarbe, he can enhance them, he can give them greater strength. V'yiyafu ne'arim v'yiga'u uvachurim kashol yikashelo. And even though at present it seems that even young men grow faint and grow weary and trip and fall, koye Hashem, those who put their faith and their trust in God, like from the word to have tikva, those who place their tikva, their hope and trust in God, yachalifu koach, their strength will be renewed. Ya'aluei verkanisharim, they will not only be able to run, yarutsu v'lo yiga'u, yelchu v'lo yi'afu, but they will be able to be as fleet as eagles in flight. So even if the Haftarah had no connection to this week's Sidra, we would value it nevertheless in the idea that this is a Haftarah. This is speaking to the Jewish people in what has been for 2,000 years an almost perpetual exile. Jewish people who individually and communally have been looking upon themselves as though God had forgotten them, who see themselves expending their efforts fruitlessly. It's a haftarah of consolation. And it tells them that their strength will yet be renewed and God will give them what is justly theirs. But the Haftarah can't end here, and it doesn't end here, and it moves on. And it moves on to a segment in which there is indeed a reference to this week's Sidra. You can see it if you already looked at one of the last lines visible on this screen, and you see it underlined in purple. There is the reference to Abraham. But let's, before we get to Abraham, Hacharishu elai iyim uleumim yachalifu cho'ach. Isaiah speaks to the Jews not only in Babylonia, but to those who are spread wherever they have gone, wherever the Babylonians have led them in captivity, or wherever they have moved on voluntarily on their own. Iyim technically means islands, but it doesn't necessarily mean an island that's surrounded on all sides by water. It could be a place of habitation that's surrounded either by water or surrounded perhaps by desert or something else, right? And he tells them again, the le'umim yachalifu koach, the same phrase that we saw previously, that their strength is going to be renewed. Yigeshu az yedaberu yachdav la mishpat nikrava, and the time at which they will be judged and they will be given that which is rightly theirs, right, is coming soon. And now we get a rhetorical question. Me, right, who? Mi heir mi mizrach. Who was it who awoke or who wakened the east? Tzedek yikra'ehu liraglo. Who was it who, in whose footsteps, in whose wake, there was always tzedek, always justice, or always grace? That person, the one who awakened in the east and who performed acts of grace, yitain lefanav goyim umalachim yard. Kings and dominions will fall prostrate before him. Yiten ke'afar charbo kekash nidaf kashto, and they will fall before him. He will slay them with his sword and with his arrows. Yirdefem, he will pursue them. Ya'avor shalom, but he himself will pass through in peace. Orach baraglav lo yavo, and he will not stumble, he will not trip along the way. Remind you of anybody? Well, if you already guessed that this is reminiscent of Avraham, then you understand why this Haftarah was chosen to accompany this week's Sidra. Not only because there is an explicit reference to Abraham, that's the passage underlined in purple towards the bottom, Va'ata Yisrael Abdi, the Jewish people, God's servant, Yaakov Asher B'charticha, Yaakov, who amongst the patriarchs is always referred to as the chosen, the select of God, Zera Avraham Ohavi, particularly you are the descendants of Abraham, who was so dear to me. Even apart from this explicit reference to Avraham, we have an allusion to Avraham. What in this week's Sidra does this allude to? The key, of course, is in the phrase Yitain lefanav goyim umalachim yard, that God puts nations, he lays them low before him and enables him to be sovereign over kings. That was one of the items I listed previously as being one of the several vignettes in this week's Sidra. The story of how Abraham was told that his nephew Lot had been taken captive by four marauding Mesopotamian kings, who, in spite of the fact that they were only four, were nevertheless able to overcome five local Canaanite kings. And in the process, they raided the city of Sodom and took its population, including Lot, captive. And when Abraham was informed of Lot's captivity, he gathered his retainers and he set out in pursuit of them all the way from where he was living in the south, in the Negev, up to a place called Dan, which if it is the same Don as you would find it on a map of the state of Israel today, is almost the northernmost point of the state of Israel today. So it was quite a considerable journey that Abraham undertook with his retainers in pursuit of these marauding Mesopotamian kings. And he successfully overtook them and successfully took Lot and the populace of Sodom and their possessions back. The continuation of the story is beyond the allusion here in the Navi, but you'll recall that the king of Sodom offered him, he said, Tain li ha-nefesh, return to me the people, b'harachush kachlach, but you're welcome to all of their property. And Avram responded, of course, with a very, very famous statement. Im michut va'ad sroch na'al, v'imekach mikol asher lach, v'lo tomar anochi e'esharti et Avram. I will take nothing, not a thread, not a shoelace, right? And I don't want anyone to be able to say, I made Abraham rich. By the way, parenthetically, strings and shoelaces, they're kind of one and the same. If you say im x ad y, then implication is that x and y are not the same. The implication is that x and y are apart from each other. In fact, usually, if you're going to say from x to y, the distance between x and y is very often the distance between heaven and earth, right? When you want to say everything in between, you say from top to bottom. Now, of course, top to bottom isn't always, you know, however many million miles is it is from the earth to the sun, or however, you know. But what did Abraham mean when he said, im michut, from a thread, va'ad sroch na'al, and all the way to a shoelace, I will take nothing. Threads and shoelaces are one and the same. So a possible answer is that yes, a chut is a thread or a string, but just as a shoelace is a particular thread or a string, so is a chut. And that if Abraham was dressed in those days the way that we most often imagine our patriarchs to have been dressed, and that is the way that we either see or imagine Bedouin to dress, then you know that he certainly wore a kafiyah, right? That's the Arabic word for a kippah, right? It's the same root in both languages, right? In Hebrew, though, we put a dagesh in the face, so it becomes a kippah. And in Arabic, there is no dagesh, so it's a kafiyah, okay? And you know that what keeps the kafiyah on your head? There's a very, very special round kind of, right, thread or string that holds the kafiyah in place. So if indeed, and I said, we don't really know. I mean, there are no surviving photographs of Abraham. Best we can do probably is to pull out some Rembrandt portrait of him, but who knows what that was based on. But on the reasonable assumption that Bedouins in the biblical period dressed not very differently from the way that Bedouins dress today, then it could very well be that Abraham was saying to the king of Sodom, from top to bottom, I'll take nothing. Or if you wish, from head to toe, im michut, right? From the string that holds my kafiyah in place, from head to toe, to the sroch na'al, I will take nothing of yours. Okay. So here we have again, right, the identification of Avraham. And these are simply, you'll see on the source sheets, I just simply found some of the sources, the medieval commentators. Rashi identifies this with Avraham. Ibn Ezra took issue with him, and I identified it with Koresh, Cyrus, the king of Persia. But Radak agreed with Rashi that it was our patriarch Abraham. So depending upon who you plan to vote for next week, we have to find out whether you vote for Rashi and Radak or whether you vote for Ibn Ezra. But either way, okay. Now, as long as we made reference to Abraham's pursuit of the Mesopotamian kings, I just thought I would share this with you very quickly. It's there again in the sources, and you can spend as much time on it as you want. Let's just show you something interesting. First of all, there are no extra biblical, that means outside of Tanakh, there are no extra biblical sources that tell us anything about this battle between Abraham and the Mesopotamian kings. But nevertheless, we can make some informed guesses about who the participants were and what its objectives were. I'm not going to do that now. That's not the part that interests me now. What interests me is the middle part. The names of the five Canaanite kings who were beaten and taken captive by the marauding Mesopotamians and who were freed by Abraham. And you notice something very interesting. You can see what I highlighted in red. The first one is called Bera, the king of Sodom. Bera means the one who lives or resides or exists in evil. Birsha, Melech Amora, the king of Amora, his name was Birsha. Ra, Resha, synonyms. Okay. Shin Av, Sone Av, right? Maybe he hated his own father, maybe he had an Oedipus complex, or maybe he hated whatever the deity was. Shem Aver Melech Tzvoyim, right? Shem Aver. Now the Aver who's usually connected to Shem, that's a different name that's spelled with an ayin. This is Sam Aver. This is the idea of somebody who kept on pointing, kept on raising his hand. The idea is I didn't point out, but I'm sure you noticed, right? That this is clearly the origin of the five towns. Right? These are the original five towns. Whatever Woodmere and Lawrence and Cedarhurst, you know, will want you to think, right? The original five towns were Sodom, Amora, Adma, Tzvoyim, and Tzoar. Okay. By the way, the organization of relatively nearby cities, their organization for perhaps mutual defense and the like, the organization into groups of five. We see it in the Bible also with the Philistines, right? You may recall that the Philistines had five cities, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gat, and Aza, right? So this idea of organization by fives, it even has a name, right? It's a combination of two Greek words, the word for city, which is polis, and the word for five, which you all know from the five-sided building in Washington, is penta, a pentapolis. A pentapolis is an organization, a social or political organization of five cities. So I just thought that this was something worth pointing out. Okay. But we're not done with the Haftarah. So let me get to the conclusion of the Haftarah before I totally run out of time. Okay. So remember again, going back to the beginning, to those psukim at the tail end of chapter 40, the ones that were addressing the people who needed consolation. So here we have again a renewal of the theme of consolation. Al tira kimcha ani, right? People of Israel, do not fear because God is with you. Al tishtaq, which is a poetic synonym of to fear, do not tremble. Ki ani Elohecha, because I am your God. Immatzticha, I gave you omets, I've given you strength. Af azarticha, I am always there to assist you. Af tamachticha b'yamin tzidki, and I've always supported you. I have upheld you with my justice, with my right arm, which is the sign of God's justice. Hen yevoshu v'yikalamu kol anecharim bach, all those who take up arms against you, all those who rage against you, they will find reason to be ashamed and to be embarrassed. Yihiyu cha'ayim, they will be as naught. V'yikalmu kol anecharim bach, all those who enrage against you, they will take shame. Yihiyu cha'ayim v'yovdu anshei rivecha, anyone who, again, who opposes you will be like nothing. Tevak shame, so much of a nothing that if you try to look for them, lo timtza'em, you're not even going to be able to locate them. They will be like naught, like nada, like zero, like zilch, like efes. Can't do better than efes, right? Anshei milchamtecha, those who have waged war against you. Why? Ki ani Hashem Elohecha, machazik yiminecha. Because God is the one who upholds your right hand, who gives you strength. Ha'omer lecha, and he says to you, al tira, don't fear, ani azarticha, I am the one who will come to your assistance. And you notice again the threefold repetition, al tira, ani azarticha, al tira, ani azarticha, al tira'i, okay, in the feminine gender, right? Ani azartich, similarly in the feminine gender. But notice again, do not fear, I am with you. Add one last note. Maybe of interest to those amongst you who have studied Ugaritic. I know it's not particularly popular these days, but I guess that once upon a time, somebody must have stumbled across it. I made reference to it last week when I mentioned, Moshe David Kesuto, the Israeli Bible scholar, Israeli, he was around in the early years of the State of Israel, who was quite knowledgeable in Ugaritic literature. The city of Ugarit was one of the cities of the Phoenicians to the north of the land of Israel, in which archaeologists in the early decades of the 20th century discovered a particularly rich trove of cuneiform inscriptions, which when they were deciphered, turned out to have been written in a Semitic language, which anybody who knows biblical Hebrew well can read Ugaritic. And they tell us a lot about the people who lived in the land of Canaan on the eve of the conquest by the people of Israel. And it tells us a lot primarily about their religion and a lot about their mythology. And an interesting thing is that one of the characters in Ugaritic mythology is called an Ozer. But in Ugaritic, it means a hero. It's the Ugaritic poetic equivalent of Gibor. A Gibor in Ugaritic is called an Ozer. There's a comparable phrase in biblical Hebrew. It appears very rarely, but it's called Ozrei HaMilchama. Some people think that Ozrei HaMilchama means mercenaries, right? That is people whom you hire to help you out in battle, because otherwise, if you're simply looking at a fellow soldier, why would you call him an Ozer HaMilchama? You'd simply call him a Chayal or an Ish Tzava, okay? But the interesting thing then is that it offers the possibility that the Shorish Ayin Zayin Resh, when it occurs in contexts such as ours, doesn't just mean to help somebody out like a Boy Scout might help an old lady across the street. Right, to give the proverbial instance of helping somebody out. But that when used in a context like this, it harkens back to an older poetic usage in which it specifically means to give somebody assistance in battle, to lend military assistance. So here God is not only telling the Jewish people that he is going to help them, right, but he's telling them more specifically that he is going to fight their battles. Well, that's pretty much it. Let me come back to all of you and see if there have along the way, oh my, seem to be a lot of things here on the chat. So let me just go through quickly. Yosef may be one of the Ushpizin, but he's not a patriarch. The patriarchate actually stops with Jacob. From Jacob on, his sons, Joseph, one of them, are the 12 tribes, but they're really no longer called Avot. They're no longer called patriarchs. Tonight is Rachel's Yahrzeit. Okay, I have no reason to doubt it. I'd be hard pressed to prove it. But I'm glad that at least that we mentioned her and at least called attention to the fact that she's the most popular matriarch in the Bible. Was Canaan less a land of idolatry than Mesopotamia? No. With the exception of Abraham, everybody was an idolater in those days. Although you got to ask the question, right? Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, is called a Kohen Le'el Elyon. Now, some people say that El Elyon is just the name of the chief deity of the Canaanite pantheon. He had a lot of gods. He served a lot of gods. But the chief one was called El Elyon. That we would call him top dog, pardon the expression. Okay. Others, however, maintain that it's a signal of the fact that he was a monotheist. And you know, probably that the Agadah identified him with Shem, the son of Noah. Okay. Didn't Terach already leave to go to Haran on his way to Canaan? Yes, he died on the way, unable to complete his journey, which raises, of course, a very interesting question. As if Terach was already on his way to the land of Canaan, then what was so particular about Abraham continuing the journey? That's a very good question, and it's dealt with by some of the commentaries. Yes, somebody here named some of the five towns for me. Can I elaborate on Shem Aver pointing up? I'd really rather not in polite company. I suggest that you look at the Little Midrash says. If it's in the Little Midrash says, then you're welcome to say it here in public. But I'm guessing that it's not in the Little Midrash says. It may only be in Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews. And even then, you'd probably be hard-pressed to say it in public. I hope that I've been sufficiently circuitous in my answer to point in the right direction without being unnecessarily gross. What else do we have here? The source is from Devarim. What the source is from Devarim do is that it ties the place names in this week's Sidra to the conquest during the time of Moses and Joshua. There are a lot of place names that are thrown about. It talks about a people called the Rephaim in a place called Ashtarot Karnayim. It talks about a people called Zuzim in a place called, get this, Hum, right? And it talks about a people called Emim in a place called Shaveh Kiryatayim. All of these different people, the Rephaim, the Zuzim, and the Emim, and all of these different places are mentioned in the opening chapters of the book of Devarim as places that were conquered by the Jewish people in Moses' own lifetime. They were situated pretty much in the north in the Galilee, north of the Kinneret, east of the Jordan River. Okay? The territory that the Torah calls the Bashan. So since Abraham, if you remember, went from Beersheba in the south, right, all the way up to Dan in the north, it's not surprising that these locales, right, were the locales in which the fighting took place, right? Both the fighting between the Mesopotamians and the Canaanites and the later fighting between the Mesopotamians and Abraham took place in the northern part of the land of Israel. And the Sukkim from Devarim just simply help us to situate those places. And they also hint at an identification of these indigenous people who were defeated by the Mesopotamians. The Rephaim, the Zuzim, also called Zamzumim, and the Emim, who apparently were a race of giants. I don't really know how tall you had to be in those days in order to be a giant. I can tell you that you probably know from your own experience or from your family lore that if you tried to dress up in your great-grandparents' clothing, you wouldn't be able to, because nowadays the average people are considerably taller than their great-grandparents were. So if today, right, you have to be 7'1" in order to be a center, right, in the NBA, because everybody else is 7 feet tall, right? So nowadays we imagine that a giant has to be 10 feet tall. But it could very well be that back in those days, if the average height was 5'6", it could be that somebody who was 6'8" was a giant. All right. So I don't really know, you know, how gigantic these people actually were. The Talmud says that Og, who was the surviving Rephaim, the surviving king of the Bashan, he slept in a bed that was 9 cubits long. Now, 9 cubits is arguably 13 feet, okay? But I leave you with the following thought, okay? You don't have to be 13 feet tall to sleep in a 13-foot long bed. Okay. With that thought, that merry thought, I leave you all. Thank you for your company this evening, and looking forward to seeing you again next week.